Good evening. My name is Margaret Beatty, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, the Department of History, the Max Cotta Foundation, and Betty and Dan Churchill, I would like to welcome you to tonight's event, Beyond the Wall. Robert Frost's poem, Mending Wall, narrates the story of two neighbors who debate the purpose of a stone wall between their property. While one of the men claims that good fences make good neighbors, the other one believes that something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. Like these neighbors, East and West Germany were on opposite sides of their own ideological and literal wall. Communism believed in good fences, and democracy wanted them down. So when the Berlin Wall fell in November of 1989, more than just concrete fell to the ground. Along with the physical fall of the wall came the symbolic collapse of the Cold War. We are fortunate to have with us this evening three panelists to discuss life beyond the wall. Professor Alan Stolberg is the director of the National Security Policy Program and a professor of National Security Studies at the U.S. Army War College. He served as a political military planner for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe in the Strategy and Plans Directorate of the Joint Staff during the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Professor Wolfgang Müller is a former member of Dickinson's German department, where he taught German language and literature. In 1974, he was able to escape East Berlin by dressing up in a U.S. soldier's uniform that had been smuggled across the wall to him. Jana Simon, who is a journalist for Berlin's weekly newspaper, Die Zeit, is unable to attend this evening's event because of illness. In her absence, Professor Sarah Magahi, chair of Dickinson's German department, will relay her talk. And serving as moderator of our panel is Professor Andrew Wolf of Dickinson's Political Science Department. At this time, I would like to ask that you please turn off all electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because this program is being taped and some of our audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has come to you before beginning to speak. And now, please join me in welcoming our moderator and panelists.
Good evening. My name is Andy Wolf. I'm a professor here at Dickinson College, and I will be the moderator for this panel. Just want to explain the format before we begin. Each of the panelists will come up and give a presentation, and then after that, the three will sit here in these three chairs, and I will try to spark a conversation amongst the three panelists about the meaning of the fall of the wall, its impact, its implication, what has changed, what had been lost, etc. And then once we do that for about 15, 20 minutes, we will open up for the audience to ask questions to all the panelists. So, and to begin with, I am going to give a very brief overview, kind of get your brain flowing, kind of bring you back 20 years ago about the impact and the changes that occurred starting in 1989 and going up into the early 1990s. I'm going to be operating technology here, Here we go. So just to help you remember, this is a short chronology of some of the major events that occurred in 1989, 90, 91, in this historic time. The fall of the Berlin Wall, as many of you know, was not an unrelated event. It was tied to a number of different revolutions and movements throughout Eastern Europe, and primarily the Polish revolutions and the Hungarian revolutions. Hungary really started off the process in May 1989. It had begun actually prior to that, but opening the border between Austria and Hungary really opened an avenue for people living into the east to walk across and escape to the Western world. In June of that year, there were Polish elections, and this was monumental because this was the first time during the Cold War that in a communist state, a non-communist party won an election. Solidarity won and was now in charge of the instruments of Polish government. In November, September and October of 89, there were numerous protest movements in East Germany, and resulting in the November fall of the Berlin Wall. And that also kicked off numerous protests in Czechoslovakia, public protests, and Bulgaria. The revolutionary spirit continued to move on. In December of 1989, you had massive protests in Romania, and the communist dictator Ceausescu was actually tried and executed. This was the first violent revolution during this time period. In March of 1990, you now have revolution infecting or growing into the Soviet Union, with Lithuania and Estonia both declaring independence. Also during that time, there is the issue of German reunification. What is Germany going to do with East and West Germany in this movement to fuse these two countries back together into one? In September of 1990, the 2+4 treaty was concluded on German reunification, and in October of 1990, Germany officially became one state again. In January of 1991, there were outbreaks of violence between Soviet police forces and local protesters in Lithuania and Latvia. Also, and quite disturbing, in the summer of 1991 was the beginning of the Balkan Wars that would last throughout the entire decade. The first war actually was with Slovenia, a very short war. It was sparked when Slovenia declared independence from Yugoslavia, and this war only lasted 10 days. Also in that summer, in July, the Warsaw Pact dissolved. It no longer existed. My presentation is growing. In August was quite a rocky time during this early time of revolution. You had a Soviet coup. The Soviet Premier Gorbachev was put under house arrest in his villa in the Crimea, and hard right wing, whichever you want to look at it. Factions within the Soviet government took charge. This coup failed, and Boris Yeltsin became the hero of the coup. He would go on to become president of Russia. Ukraine also declared independence, and the war in Croatia, that's between Yugoslavia and Croatia, began in earnest. And by December of 1991, the Maastricht Treaty created European Union, started a brand new process of integration, started the process of introducing the euro as a unified monetary unit on the continent. And as well, in December, the Soviet Union dissolved and broke up into numerous states. The Cold War was over. I want to show you some visualization of the changes. Here in 1989, this is what the world looked like in Europe. This big red blob is the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union together. This is the way the world looks. In all actuality, Yugoslavia should be sort of a pinkish red in this scenario. But in any case, within 2 years, this is the way the map looked. An explosion of new states appearing in Europe, some being resurrected from times far long ago, such as the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, but even new states being created, such as Slovenia. You also have numerous states in Yugoslavia being created. And then in the Caucasus, you had Armenia, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan being created, Ukraine, Belarus, Moldova. The political map changed drastically in just 2 years, and is still changing to this day. Montenegro is a new state in the Balkans, as well as Kosovo is the newest state in Europe. It's not quite 2 years old. Other major changes. You had changes to European political and security institutions stemming from the fall of the Berlin Wall. The NATO alliance has accepted 12 new members since the fall of the wall. This process occurred in three different phases, the last happening this year with welcoming Albania and Croatia into the alliance. And as I have already mentioned, the European community transformed itself into the European Union, and it enlarged to accept new members in the former communist East, and this was done in two waves. And my last few slides are going to show the process of the change visually of the European community and what has happened. So this is what the world looked like for the European community in 1989. The member states are in color. In 1995, you have three new members coming in, all Western, two Scandinavian countries and Austria. 2004, you have another wave. These are the first East European members coming in. And then finally, Bulgaria and Romania joined in 2007. And this is the political map of a more unified Europe. And all of these changes came about because of the fall of the wall, the end of the Cold War. And this is just this short little presentation. It's just to show you visually that the landscape has changed, political lines have changed, military lines have changed, but also, as you will hear, personal lives have changed, cultural ties have changed, economic ties have changed. And hopefully we will get into that the rest this evening. So to begin with, I'm going to have Professor Mueller come up, and he's going to start us off. Thank you.
After we heard a general overview and a wide focus about changes in Europe, I will narrow the focus a little bit, and I'll go to Germany. To Germany, I'll go to East Germany. I'll go to one city in East Germany, namely Berlin, into East Berlin. Into the focus goes to one person. That's me. But I will also talk about my generation and I hope that my personal experience has something to say about more people than just me and some other guys who I went to school with. But I do want to say that when I occasionally say we and my generation, I understand, of course, that. We and my generation, I don't speak for them, I'm one of them. But on the other hand, again, I think there's some general experience here which might be interesting for people to hear. First, I want to show you a picture. And this is really we, my generation. It is 1961, in the fall of 1961, my high school class, and I just want to tell you who we are. Okay, I don't know if you can guess where I am, but I'm the handsome guy on the right here, right here. In the microphone. What? Oh. Wonderful. Okay. Can you hear me here? All right. So here's our homeroom teacher, Herr Tippkötter. Herr Tippkötter came to East Germany as a young socialist when he was 17, 18 years old, then taught high school, lost his job in 1968 when he protested against the invasion of Czechoslovakia, and then after that became a drunk and sold flowers. He's a really beloved teacher. Klaus McKean, right next to him, became a fighter pilot. He crashed, he died, he's dead by now. A good friend of mine, Detlef, wrote poetry. Part of the poetry was political. He got 2.5 years in jail for it. The West German government bought him out after 1.5 years. Here's Jürgen Lingenau. Jürgen Lingenau became a teacher. He had to report on his students. And one night he came to my house and he was crying because he couldn't stand it anymore. Down here, though, is Katrin. Katrin was the most beautiful girl in our high school. And of course, every boy was in love with her. But It didn't lead to anything, so maybe I'll meet her one of these days. I don't know. What you see here is, as you can see, is the Berlin Wall. It's in the 80s. And what's interesting to me is you can see wild colors and graffiti on one side of the wall, and you see the death strip on the other side of the wall, and you can imagine which one is which, which side is which. Of course, from the West you could write graffiti onto the wall, from the East you couldn't. The West saw it as a canvas, the East saw it as a way to get killed or arrested or something like that, just to show you different perceptions of the wall on both sides. We were, of course, behind the wall, and we couldn't see what was behind that wall. It was a terra incognita, or a no land. Another word for no land is, of course, utopia. For Easterners of our age, this utopia became sort of almost sexually loaded. It was a desired place. It was a secret garden of wonderful images, of colors and sounds, a land where the beautiful, the charmed people lived, who could freely go wherever they wanted. Their land stretched from West Berlin to Western Europe to the American continent and Asia. Our land was a little smaller. But their land particularly stretched to a city in England, and this city in England was Liverpool. And it was, of course, the city where the Beatles resided, and right next to them, the Rolling Stones. And, of course, these were descendants of the Shadows and the American friends, the Ventures, and Bob Dylan, and John Baez, and Pete Seeger, and Steppenwolf. I don't know if you remember Steppenwolf. I do. I'm talking about the 60s and the early 70s. While we imagined utopia in its most beautiful and exciting colors and sounds, we were told that this is where the enemy lives, the class enemy, as they were called, the enemy of the working class. The government's version of our utopia was actually a dystopia, an anti-utopia. And it must have been so awful that they could not even show it on a map. Here's a map of East Berlin. And as you can see, here's East Berlin. West Berlin is pretty much white. It doesn't exist, or it was too awful to show. What was highly ironic, of course, about the wall was that some of our fathers helped to build a wall. At least mine did. And he prevented us from reaching the land we wanted to reach until some of us had gotten used to the wall and barely noticed it anymore. By chance, I found this picture that I wanted to show you. This picture is a picture of what they were called the Kampfgruppen, or party militia, who were sort of protecting, quote unquote, the wall in 1961 when it was built. Looking at this picture makes me think this is my father. He looked like that at that time, and he was there. Of course, it probably wasn't my father, but he could have easily been my father. In this slide. There's also a generational conflict between fathers and sons, fathers and mothers. But on the other hand, they protected us, so to speak, from what we thought was a utopian land. But this utopian land also had its utopian music, and I want to give you an example of the utopian music, the official utopian music of the state. Maybe some of you have heard it already, but if not, it's really worthwhile. Just a second.
Sie hat uns alles gegeben, Sonne und Wind, und sie geizte nie. Wo sie war, war das Leben. Was wir sind, sind wir durch sie. Sie hat uns niemals verlassen, fror auch die Welt, und zwar warm. Uns schön. Im Geist wächst von Stalin geschweißt
die Partei, die Partei, die Partei.
Sie hat uns nie.
Okay, well, I better stop here, otherwise I waste too much time. Even if you don't understand the text, the main phrase, die Partei hat immer recht, the party is always right. And then when you hear the chorus, which you actually didn't hear, boring. Boring, not cool. Our music, our utopia was different, and I'll give you an example for that one too. Oops, if I can get this very fast. Okay. Okay, I mean, this spoke much more to our heart in the situation. I can't get no satisfaction. But these melodies and these texts, of course, came over to East Berlin via radio waves, TV shows. The party, of course, tried to prevent us from listening to this, but that just made us much more eager to hear. This stuff. And by the way, the West German radio and TV could be seen in Berlin, where I grew up. Of course, the other people couldn't, like in Dresden. We lovingly called the Dresden area the country of the uninitiated because they couldn't listen to any Western station at all, I think. I think I'm right about this one. But the influences, of course, did not only come from rock music and folk music and coming from the West. We had our own songwriters, and this is one of them, probably the most important one. This is Wolf Biermann, who was thrown out of country in 1996. He sings here in Cologne in 1976.
Die kalten Frauen, die mich streicheln, die falschen Freunde, die mir schmeicheln, die scharf sind auf die scharfen Sachen und selber in die Hosen machen. In dieser durchgerissenen Stadt, die hab ich satt.
So the key phrase in the text is, I'm fed up with them, I'm totally fed up, which somehow harmonized with I can't get no satisfaction that Mick Jagger sang. And so it sort of blended, the descent blended from the West and from the East. It wasn't just these two, and I'm narrowing my focus a little bit to myself. It wasn't just these voices, the songs, and the songs of the sirens from the West so to speak, which made me lose the path the party had paved and secured for me. It took the tanks of the Warsaw Pact that smashed the Prague Spring and our own hoped-for East German utopia along with it, a utopia which we call democratic socialism with a human face. And it took a little bit more. It took some more years and the forbidden love. My girlfriend and wife was, and now wife was American, before I decided I had to leave the country. So with her help and other American friends, like Ned Morse, by the way, a descendant of Samuel Morse, I don't know if you know him, he invented the Morse alphabet, he is also a painter, and Susan Lashy, who is an Iowan and now teaches in English in Hamburg, and also an American Army uniform, I managed to get through Checkpoint Charlie, the Allied checkpoint in Berlin. My name, my rank was a little disappointing. I was a Spec 4. It could have been a lieutenant or something like this, but it wasn't. And my name was Jose Rodriguez. I somehow had to explain my accent, although I'm sure the East German Border Guard's English wasn't much better than my own. First I want to show you a picture so that you really believe this of me. This in front of the Pergamon Museum in uniform. And we took the Ned took the picture because I asked him to, because I thought I wouldn't get punished harsher for the picture and maybe have something for the grandchildren later on. So we took this picture in East Berlin. But the images that I actually wanted to show you are the following. On our way out of East Berlin, this is about 1.5 hours before I got to Checkpoint Charlie, we stopped at a little hinterhouse at a courtyard in East Berlin. It's typical for the working class district in Berlin around Wedding and so on. And Ned took a picture, and what you unfortunately can't see because the picture is very old is an old man behind the window on the second floor. And I had sort of this idea, yes, that's why you go. You don't want to end up like this old man behind a window watching the world go by and you're stuck forever. The second image is just as beautiful. Unfortunately, it's also old. 10 minutes later, as we came into Wilhelm-Pieck-Straße, there was a young woman on the third floor looking out, and they blew bubbles. The little boy blew bubbles, and I thought, yeah, that is my situation. I'm blowing bubbles, and they're beautiful. I don't know whether they'll pop or not. Of course, they always pop. Mine didn't, so I was lucky, but it felt very symbolic at the time on my way to the border. Coming to West Berlin was, of course, joyous. It certainly beat being dead or in jail. But there was also a sense of confusion. An anxiety, a sense, I think, that was shared by everybody who went west and by those who the West came to in 1989. To illustrate this general point, I just want to talk for a moment about my own experience. I'm convinced that a lot of you have heard similar stories. The first and very intense feeling was that of an overload of sensory perception. I felt totally, walking down the street like Kudamm in West Berlin, the colors, the screaming ads, the products exhibited, the amount of cars and their various makes, the loud and heavy traffic, the cornucopia of food in the grocery stores in comparison to the lack of fresh produce and fruit, such as oranges and bananas, throughout the 40 years of the GDR's history. Was quite remarkable. In terms of food, there's this joke that some of you may have heard. and the joke, an East German joke. It goes something like this. Did East Germans originate from apes? And the answer is impossible. Apes could never have survived on just 2 bananas a year. In any case, after walking through the streets of West Berlin for the first time, I felt physically sick, panicky, after about an hour or so. Another strange thing was the German language. I assumed that at least, you know, I'd change government and geography, and I thought that I would at least be home in the German language. Not so. People in the West had read different books, they had seen different films, they had different life stories, and all of this colored the way they expressed themselves. To give you an example from my dealings with the authorities, for instance, on the bat of advice of a fellow East German who had escaped earlier, I applied to the Berlin Senate to be counted as a political refugee because I saw my escape as a political act, and of course, the lucky variant of a failed escape, by the way, I would have gone to jail for several years on political offenses. However, my application was refused by the West Berlin Senate because, as the letter read, I had simply changed apartments, which was true, I had changed apartments. It was a Wohnungswechsel. I had moved from one district of Berlin to the other. Well, I didn't understand it that way, so I guess we had a different idea of what political means. After I arrived in West Berlin, I enrolled at the Free University. However, the place seemed totally strange to me as well, because nobody noticed me or wanted to notice me. When I was noticed at all and identified as an escaped East German, I was seen at least by some as a traitor to the working class right in the middle of West Berlin. That seemed very strange to me too. I was particularly, at one point somebody found out I was East German because I couldn't work the Ditto machine, and I guess you can't either anymore because it's an old machine. But at the time, I was supposed to know how a Ditto machine works, but I couldn't because in East Berlin, even the typewriters had to be registered with the police, and you just couldn't copy stuff anywhere. So I had to ask somebody to do it for me, and I felt really, really dumb. I think lots of East Germans felt dumb once they got to the West, or the West came over them. Often things were not that different in the U.S. After 8 months in West Berlin, I emigrated to the U.S., landing at Kennedy Airport on my 27th birthday, shortly before Christmas. Although there I had a very comforting first experience because something happened that I totally expected. Right after I came out of the arrival hall, I heard a loud sound of a police siren, and I saw a police car chasing another car. Great, I thought. I knew this from movies. This feels like home. I had arrived. I finally had arrived. What I was not prepared for was the rural landscape on the trip west with a stopover in Amherst, Massachusetts. I had expected the country to be covered with skyscrapers and trash. What I saw, I mean, really. What I saw were one family houses with clean-looking yards, and still the images I saw in Amherst I still can't quite explain, and I want to show you what I saw. If I can find it, of course. Oh, and what I heard. First morning, I went to a bank. I needed some cash. I had travel checks. I needed cash. And I went into a bank. And what happened in the bank was quite remarkable. This is what happened. This is not in, this in Amherst, the YouTube is. Right in the middle of the bank sat a little man behind a little organ and played Bach. And I thought, by gosh, they really worship money here. I mean, you wouldn't, not even in West Germany would this happen to you. But the next thing I saw had to do with the bookstore. It was right next to the bank. It was a student bookstore. And in the bookstore was a huge poster of Lenin, smiling, looking at the bank. And I thought, the leader of the Russian Revolution in the belly of the capitalist beast, this is strange. And that feeling of strangeness did not really lose me for a while. I could, of course, continue with a million stories like that, but I'll stop. The general point of all of these impressions did not add up to a unified understanding of the new world that I had chosen. But I was craving to figure out the meaning of it all. And to paraphrase Goethe's Faust, I was longing to understand what this new world was held together by. If only to fit in there, I was a newcomer, I wanted to fit it, I wanted to understand. Looking for that center, looking for meaning, did not only have to do with trying to fit in, on the other hand. You have to understand looking for meaning is what I was doing in East Germany. Everybody and everything, they had a place in a larger narrative provided by the East German interpretation of Marxism. The same way that, let's say, religion or other belief systems play a big role in people's lives everywhere. In the GDR, there was an answer for everything, an intellectual and emotional center, a narrative that all people I knew stood in relation to, either in shades of agreement or disagreement. Now, however, that I was confronted with mosaic pieces of a new world that did not fit together at all, I didn't get the context. The astonishment and even shock I described as the experience of one person is a shock that was and is being felt way beyond the East-West conflict, I believe. It is in the most general sense the shock of modernity with its diversities, its colorfulness, its ambiguities, its charm, and its smart bombs, the shock on traditional societal structures, which play out in various parts of the world, whether it's in East Berlin, Kosovo, Kandahar, or Mogadishu. It is a platitude to say that the wall around West Berlin was built to keep the East Germans in their country. And given the number of people who succeeded in leaving the workers' and peasants' state, this platitude is certainly based on fact. However, there's a certain truth to the official East German notion that they wanted to keep the West out when they built their anti-fascist democratic protection barrier. That's what the wall was called. When they built it around West Berlin. Granted, the way they put it in their propaganda sounded rather ridiculous. Building walls to keep strangers and strange ideas out is, of course, not a new idea. The Chinese built the longest one to keep the Mongols at bay. Various philosophers and writers who imagined a new utopian world had trouble imagining this world as a place where others could join easily. The GDR was such a utopia. The secret is that this little paradise between the Elbe and the Elbe River in the west and the rivers Oder and Neisse in the east was lost precisely because, contrary to its own ideology of representing change and progress, it wanted to freeze time and prevent change and diversity. And as Gorbachev pointed out, those who come late will be punished by life. Ironic for Gorbachev, he was a little late too. Is there anything to learn about security? If I have time, otherwise I'll just skip it. Yeah. There's the old German joke that some of you probably know, slightly changed by myself. A French lieutenant, an American captain, and an East German Stasi officer go hunting to a forest to catch a fox. First, the French came back empty-handed, then the American returned unsuccessfully. Last came the Stasi officer. Triumphantly, he approached the other two with a furry creature over his back. When asked how he had caught the fox, he said with pride in his voice, "Simple. I caught this rabbit, beat him up until he confessed he was a fox." I fear that the fields we work in and their methods influence our ideas about securities a little bit too much. So for a military officer, security mostly depends on military strength. For an environmentalist, it is the intact environment. And for a bleeding heart liberal like myself, it is the happiness of the people. And we don't like very much to take advice and methods from other fields. Instead, we beat the evidence until they confess to adhere to our own theories and beliefs. To narrow my focus again to the GDR, the GDR did not break down because of economic boycotts, outside political pressure, and space missile defense, just the opposite. Outside threats gave the GDR's government a veil of legitimacy. What made it implode in the end, much to the surprise of most observers, were its self-inflicted lack of productivity and its vanishing lack of purpose and meaning, something that the West seems to have lost too at the very moment the communist systems started to crumble. If you remember Gorbachev again, he said something like, "We will rob you of your enemy." And I think that is what happened right after the fall of the wall. So in order not to go down with its former enemy and keep current antagonists at bay, modernity itself has to hold on to a compelling narrative, a visionary and emotional center. Building better cars and missiles and having a chicken in each pot is not the answer, and neither is bigotry and hypocrisy. Thank you.
I am not Yana Simon. I am an academic named Sarah McGahey, and thus I have to comment on Yana Simon's paper. I cannot just read it. And I have two major comments before I begin. One is, I think we need to remember that Yana is a generation younger than Professor Müller, who just spoke. She's born in 72, so she has her youth in the early 80s, the mid-80s. She's a teen in the late 80s. And she's in college and at the university right after the wall falls. And I think you'll find when you're listening to me perform Yana that she is also saying something about performing and performing identity, both personal, national, European. I think there are other very interesting aspects to it as well. But it's her story, so with that, I will read. My failed attempt to become Italian. In my childhood, to me, Europe meant Italy. La Strada was the first film which made me cry. I worshipped the Italian art of cooking, and once I received a postcard of Rome's Spanish stairs in the sunshine. It had happened. I had fallen in love. Italy united all my childhood wishes and longings. Spaghetti with lots of tomato sauce, gelato in all its flavors, good-looking, dark-haired young men on mopeds, in convertibles, on narrow coastal streets, the sweet life of siesta, a mixture of idleness and complete beauty. I drew the outline of Italy on the wall of my room, stuck pictures next to it, and marked the most important cities with a black point. I lived far away from these places, in East Berlin of the 80s, and dreamt of a country that I had never seen and probably would never see. I had as slim a chance of seeing it as the rest of Western Europe. In school, I immersed myself in educated discussions with my best friend. She had only one fault. She preferred France. One day, it was in geography class, she looked at me from the side and whispered in my ear, "Yana, you know, the Italians are lazy." Following that remark, I did not speak to her for a few days. She had injured my sense of national pride, and I contemplated revenge. To my delight, I could claim triumph shortly thereafter. Italy became world soccer champions in 1982, and France landed defeated in fourth place. The GDR didn't participate in such tournaments, and even if they had, I doubt that I would have considered them my home team. It was a life in the absurd. Our daily life rarely came into contact with our fantasy world. We separated them carefully. In class, we wrote of the superiority of the socialist system, the completely calculated five-year plans with brown coal, potassium salt, machine building. Too bad that there still wasn't any ketchup and no Depeche Mode albums. We received postcards with ugly socialist buildings on the front. Girls and boys from the Soviet Union who were completely foreign to us wrote, "Dear German friend, I congratulate you on the birthday of the Telemann Pioneer Organization, your Soviet friend." The Telemann Pioneer Organization was the children's communist organization that children belonged to. I wrote similar sentences on postcards of the Berlin TV tower and sent them to Moscow or Vladivostok. Everyone knew we would never see each other, never meet one another. We were happy about that. The thought of meeting and having to talk about the Telemann Pioneer Organization only created a feeling of panic. At school, my friend and I continued to live out our secret lives as Westerners. We passed notes in class in which we discussed Madonna's hairstyles. We planned our future far away in Rome and Paris. Perhaps we Easterners were the first true Europeans. We changed our nationality every day. We slipped into nationalities and took them off again as we liked, completely innocent as we did so. In our mind, we already lived in a Europe without borders. And actually, the translation of innocent is tough. I would actually even say unsuspecting, too. When I entered the third grade, I decided to transform myself into an Italian. For that, I needed, indeed I couldn't avoid, the language. My first Italian, a Herr Kunz, or Mr. Short, wore gray synthetic pants, had a dark beard, and his eyes disappeared behind a pair of glasses whose lenses were so large that they reached almost to his chin. He must have gotten them in the Soviet Union. I had imagined my Herr Kunz as somewhat more Mediterranean. Well, I was ready to take on the task of becoming Italian nonetheless. Once a week from then on, I traveled to Herr Kunz, who lived in a new high-rise in Berlin-Lichtenberg. The lessons hour was always the same. Frau Kurz placed a glass of sea buckthorn juice before me on the ochre-colored coffee table. Then I drew my notebook out of my bag and recited vocabulary next to their brown wardrobe. Slowly, I left my home and became an intermediate being. I lived as an underground Italian in East Berlin and felt, as I did so, somehow subversive. It also had a lot to do with the fact that my quote-unquote real identity did not particularly appeal to me. Who belongs happily to a world in which bands named themselves Kreisel or Inka, in which citizens beat each other up over neon nail polish on sale, or in which one was used to greeting the suspected listener on the line every time we used the phone? This identity, my identity, was a magnificent mosaic. It consisted of a colorful group of individual parts which had no connection to one another. Today, I could be an Italian for a day, tomorrow an English woman. I became a master of performance and of self-denial. My friend and I went to Budapest one summer in the late 1980s. Budapest was our capital of the West and the East. It is an irony of history that Hungary was only able to join the EU after the former GDR. In Budapest, there was Coca-Cola, pink-colored pants, and you could see flash dance in the theater. One evening in July 1987, we decided to be English for a night. We teased our hair, applied black mascara, and went out. On the way to the disco, we stopped every once in a while, yelled, "Wonderful!" in English, and asked passersby for directions in English, even though we did not need them. And I am cutting a little here. She continues to discuss this, this moment, which is interesting, but we don't have that much time. But I didn't want to see the performance, to comprehend it. And so another story of courageous deception took place later. At a campground in the Hungarian Balaton region at the end of the 80s, I met two girls from Holland. We chatted for a while, and then they asked the question, the inevitable question, where was I from? "From West Berlin," I answered unflinchingly, despite the fact that my father's Lada with its East Berlin license plates was parked in front of our tent for all to see. I planned a long, complicated story. I live with my mother, I said, which was true. And she immigrated to West Berlin, which was not true. Only during the summer vacation do I spend time with my East German father. I tilted my head to the side and looked at the two girls earnestly. It was just so complicated, I explained. This story had the advantage that I did not need to speak English. I had perfected my method from Bulgaria. The lie stole my summer. From that point on, I lived in constant fear that my true identity would be revealed, or that my father would give me away by accident. I wore only my most colorful t-shirts, spent my entire day reading a much-thumbed Donald Duck comic book, and contemplated whether I should remove the East German patch from my towel or not. After all, one of the Hollanders could catch me in the shower with an East German towel. That would open the door to dangerous conclusions. I was so preoccupied with my new identity that I slowly grew lonely. I did not know exactly whom I had told what, so I preferred to speak to no one. My own self-made myth prevailed against me. For a short moment, I melded with my new identity. I could taste it, the sweetness of the West, lifted out of the bleak and tedious daily life in the East. Alas, the feeling did not last long. Afterward, it tasted bitter, like deception and betrayal. In the end, I was happy when my father and I drove away and I could give up the game. My Italian transformation also stalled. Herr Kurz did not call anymore. Curiously, after he had asked me all about all aspects of my family life and relations, he disappeared into nowhere. I never heard from him again. It was unfortunate. In an environment in which everything was classified as political, I had enjoyed the apolitical hours spent along the Lido in Venice. The culmination of my political socialization occurred in the 11th grade in 1989, when in geography class we were asked to evaluate the geological emergence of the Fold Mountain, dialectically. No god was allowed to have played a holy role in this act of nature. Even the mountain stood on R, the GDR side. Nevertheless, the GDR fell just a short time later. I had left the GDR long ago, only the GDR had not noticed it. The time of the reunification was extreme in all respects. That an entire system, along with its disliked representatives and products, could disappear is an experience that separates us from our generation in the West. All authorities found themselves in a state of disintegration. Our feared civics teacher ended up in psychiatric care. The formerly influential principal went into early retirement. Books were piled up next to garbage cans, books with the history of the working class and parts of which we had had to memorize. People who have experienced that once find it hard to ever believe in authorities again or to take political parties seriously. Because we saw that nothing is certain and permanent, no system, no party, no authority, not even a previously mighty world order. At some point in this period, my notion of certainty got lost. Before the fall of the wall, I considered myself a West European at heart, stuck in the East due to a cosmic error. Now that the system had changed, I would finally be delivered unto my natural environment. To my great surprise, no one in the West recognized my true identity. They considered me a true East German from the East, which I had never been in my own memory. Everyone assumed that I could speak fluent Russian, was intimately familiar with the works of Karl Marx and the teachings of dialectical materialism. Only none of that had interested me. After my embarrassing experience in Budapest, I had concentrated my efforts on the English language, and I also felt secure with the wisdom of Donald Duck. So I didn't fit the profile given me in any respect. But at the same time, I couldn't really talk the talk. Although I was well acquainted with Milky Ways, Levi's, and Madonna, the fine distinctions still left me at a loss. I had no idea how this state, this West European structure, was set up. In theory, yes, but not what held it together at its foundations. I was floating, cut free from time and space in a kind of no man's land. When in 1992 I then traveled, finally, in the flesh, to Italy, the land I had yearned for, I was simultaneously happy and disappointed. In Perugia, it was hot, the cappuccino was creamy, the occasional older gentleman would take a siesta, but it all had very little to do with me. I shared a room with a Dutch woman. There were English people, Austrians, Swiss, even Brazilians, but the only one from the East was me. Sometimes I felt as if I were observing my flatmates from a great distance. Sympathetically, to be sure, but their experiences at anti-nuclear protests in Gorleben in the West and on high school exchanges to the U.S. left me strangely unaffected. My stories about our Major Mendel, our high school military arts teacher, parties with cola vodka, the decision whether or not I should join the Free German Youth, and songs like "The Spanish Sky Spreads Its Stars Over Our Trenches" sounded to my listeners exciting, almost exotic, but they now divided me from them. Suddenly, an unexpected gravity and seriousness began to weigh down all past events. For me, there seemed to be no further category to flee into. So I tried to transform myself back from an Italian wannabe into a perfect East European. Shortly after traveling to Italy, I started studying Russian and went to Moscow for the first time. Earlier in the GDR, I had refused to go there. For an Italian in exile in the East, that was simply out of the question. In the Great Big East, I lived with a Russian woman, Irena, who was an unemployed French teacher, and her adult daughter, Katya. I never managed to figure out how the two spent their days. Whenever I came or went, they were always wearing floral patterned terry cloth robes and blow-drying their hair. Katya had just gotten divorced at the age of 23 and seemed unhappy that her mother had surrendered her childhood bedroom to me so that she now had to sleep on the couch. Perhaps that's why she eyed me with a kind of detached condescension or ignored me entirely. So I was very surprised one morning when she accosted me in the kitchen and asked me sleepily who had won more medals in the last Olympics, Germany or Russia. "Probably Russia," I answered. She lit a cigarette. Her hand sank to the table with a gesture as if to say, "Thought as much." She turned around and disappeared with no further words. She only wanted to show this clueless Westerner, who probably still knew nothing about the glorious victories of the former Soviet power, where she stood. I understood Katya very well. I saw the colorful calendars of German shepherds on the wall and the leather-bound volumes of Lenin under the bed. Yearning was attached to every object here, to the plastic figurines from the Kinder chocolate eggs on display behind glass, to the Coca-Cola sticker on her wardrobe. It was as if I were looking in a mirror back into the past. I could feel the narrowness, the melancholy. I knew her dreams, but there was no longer any trust between us. I had switched sides. In her eyes, I was a West European. Today, whenever I go to the former East, I am now the woman from the West. Recently, I went to Azerbaijan for a report, a country with a lot of oil which has left ugly black lakes everywhere, and with a president and former KGB boss who loves to bombard his citizens with pictures and sayings of himself. In a cafe in Baku, I met with an opposition politician. He talked at me for several hours and tried to hypnotize me with his eyes. No doubt this man had a mission. His country was part of Europe and nowhere else, he said. Democracy and Western values had been deeply ingrained in Azerbaijan for centuries, he said. I felt like as if I were an EU diplomat who was supposed to deliver a judgment right away, for or against Azerbaijan and Europe. I looked at him and felt bad for him. How should I know what Europe really is and who should be a part of it or not? I always imagined Europe as a big house, somewhere in Brussels. A great deal of files are stored there. They occasionally get pushed back and forth. Now and then one gets lost or deliberately mislaid. Regulations are made about condom sizes and how apples are supposed to look. I don't know what that has to do with me. The opposition politician across from me began to sweat. Small wet stains were forming on his shirt. And there, all of a sudden, I had this GDR feeling again. Someone is trying desperately to play along in the world of the important people and just doesn't want to miss the boat. In this instant, I mimic the role of West European, the one who you explain the world to, including communism, from whom gifts are expected, and for whom one always has time, even if other appointments are pressing. I observe myself in this role, and I try not to make any mistakes, not to offend anyone or seem arrogant. I couldn't tell the opposition politician about my failed transformation into an Italian. He would have considered that an overreaction, so I kept silent. "My report is about oil," I said at the end, and wished him luck.
Okay. What I'd like to do is I'm going to start off talking a little bit about the micro and bring it up to the macro. I'll talk a little bit about my own personal experiences starting as a second lieutenant on the West German-East German border. And I intend to try and take that up to a point where I want to be very provocative and offer an issue to you and a hypothesis about how complicated the world has become to a certain degree because of what occurred 20 years ago and what that means for us today and potentially for us in the future. Let me start off and talk a little bit about the beginning. I remember Steppenwolf, and I remember the song Born to Be Wild. And it was a wild time in the 60s and 70s for those of us thinking about these kinds of problems. I showed up as a young second lieutenant in 1975 in Bamberg, Germany. Bamberg, Germany is the place where they had this town called Town Without Pity. There was a famous Gene Pitney song and a movie made about it where there was a terrible rape of a German girl and some GIs were tried. But what happened is, for those of us who were there at that time, the post-Vietnam Army, the Vietnam Army at the time, the Germans didn't like us very much in a place called, which was basically the zone of the interior, outside of Berlin. And so it was kind of a difficult time. I was an infantry officer at the time. I took command of my rifle platoon on the East German border. And we all really, if we were honest with ourselves, we didn't completely know what we were doing at that time. And the other guys really didn't either. And it was kind of like Mad Magazine with spy versus spy. And I still remember, I took command of my platoon, and the next day I went out on a patrol. And one of my sergeants told me to look through the binoculars because there was an East German patrol watching us and we were watching them and neither of us really did much with it. We just stood there in the woods. This was not unusual. I came back then a few months later and I took my platoon through a course in Berlin. We went to Berlin for the first time. Berlin was totally different from an American perspective, American military perspective. At that time, than everywhere else in Germany. People liked us there. We were welcomed with open arms. The girls would date us. They liked us. That did not happen in the zone of the interior. It was very, very hard to get into a disco anywhere then because they thought you were going to do something bad there, sell drugs or things like that. But going to Berlin, this was a city that the German government had put a lot of money into, the German people had put a lot of money into, the West Berliners had a great deal of pride, and so the architecture was nice, the streets were clean, the vehicles were the newest. Our soldiers there had very new buildings that they lived in. When they went to eat, their mess halls were like going to a college dorm, cafeteria. They drove really nice Mercedes Jeeps, and we had old American Jeeps, and on and on. And so you got the impression right away, there's something different here. Right after getting there, we went to my unit went on a small run along the wall. We ran 5 miles along the wall, and you got to see the guard towers things like that. But it was a really pretty spring day. And so it didn't look that bad, and it was very remote, and we were having too much fun, so it didn't mean that much. Now, let me move it up 10 years later, mid-80s. Reagan administration, Brezhnev administration, the world had gotten harsher that time between East and West. In March of 1985, Soviet soldier had shot an American major in East Germany in a place where he was authorized. And I went there in November of that year, and the weather was very foggy, some snow, very, very cold, very, very harsh. And it was a very, very difficult time in our bilateral relationship. And so you get a very, very cold feeling. Things are not good. We're not about to go to war, but you didn't have the warmth and the comfort that you did from 10 years before, where people didn't seem to care that much. Then we move it up a few years later, 1989, at this period. At that time, I happened to be the Soviet East European specialist for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So when this happened, it fooled all of us. This was a big, big surprise. Things were moving so quickly, they were out of control. I had a counterpart at that time by the name of Condoleezza Rice. She was in the National Security Council staff. And we were direct counterparts for 2 years. And we would have lunch and dinner together, and we were trying to sort this stuff out along with a bunch of other people. And it was very, very difficult. We had no precedents to go with. And so the world was moving. We felt we were in the midst of a revolution, and everything we were doing, we were trying to figure out what comes next. We hadn't even fixed what came before. Very, very interesting time, very complicated time, not necessarily a bad one, but something that led to what I would suggest to you, and here's where I want to start getting a little provocative. This world started, all of a sudden, it got real hard. It was very simple up till November of 1989. You had the East, you had the West, you had the Cold War. Everybody knew where they stood. And you read the literature today, and you've seen it, or you've lived it. Everybody knew what was what. We'd been doing the same thing for decades. There were no major shocks or surprises in the relationship between East and West. This turned our world upside down, not just the military world, not just the political world, but I'd suggest to a certain degree the cultural world. And you just heard some examples of that from our two previous speakers. And so in this confused world, everyone had to learn how to adapt, and that was not easy. I can remember in the early 90s, and during this period between 1975 and 2002, I had the great opportunity to spend 15 years in Germany. So I was able to see this evolution through American eyes and through American government eyes. And this was very difficult for the Europeans, this period between 1989 and perhaps up to 2000. I can remember in about 2002 going across the East German border to some smaller towns and talking to mayors and things like that. And they were having a tremendous struggle. On the one hand, they wanted to immediately be like the West and adapt everything that was the West. But on the other hand, they wanted to slow things down. Things were almost moving too quickly. This was very, very hard for them. Now, one of the things that had happened, and perhaps the most, I would suggest to you, the most important and dynamic piece of all, was that from the perspective of all of these countries, now that there was no longer part of the Warsaw Pact, there was no Soviet Union, the threat was gone. Now, what did that mean to everybody? And here's the hypothesis I want to put to you for your consideration this evening. One of the things that I would suggest it did that's having a dramatic impact, not just then, but it's having an impact today and tomorrow on us, is within Europe writ large, there is a much greater reluctance to employ force when some would deem it necessary in the world today than ever before. This is something that began with the end of the Second World War, the abhorrence, the horrible losses of both the First and Second World Wars, territory destroyed, populations destroyed, families decimated. This is not surprising that this occurred in many ways. What I would suggest to you, though, is that the fall of the wall and the demise of the threat speeded things up considerably. And so it made this issue dominant in cultures where before it had been subdued, because the threat always existed. So now what I'd like to do is I'd like to give you a couple of ideas and examples how this manifested itself, and for some consideration this evening of what this may mean for the future. As a matter of fact, let me show you something before I forget. What do I have to do to expand this? I'm sorry. Oh, I got it. I saw. Or here, too. Okay. I want to show you a little bit of polling data real quickly to really illustrate this very quickly. This was the Chicago Marshall Fund, 2005, talking about looking at Europe writ large, hawks, pragmatists, isolationist dubs. Now, remembering, clearly, the events of Iraq have clouded this. There's nothing simple here, and nothing here is black and white. But I'd suggest there's a pattern that's about to unfold in the next several slides, and that is the United States up here, we are clearly on the hawk and pragmatic side, and Europe is more towards the isolationist and dove side. Now, what does that mean as you take that further? Polling data, 2006 period. Support for the use of force, U.S. and Europe. If the U.S. chose to do something alone, only 36% of the European population would support the use of force. U.S. and its allies, 41%. With NATO, 44%. With a U.N. Security Council resolution, which is where, in theory, the legitimacy comes from in international law, still, only less than 50% of Europeans would support the use of force. Americans, almost 79%. A couple of other pieces. Here the question became, same time period, sometimes war is necessary to obtain justice. Even with that, less than 50% of Europeans would agree to the use of force. U.S. is clearly much further to the right, Great Britain as well, the Netherlands a little bit. But when you look at countries like France, Italy, Portugal, Poland, much harder, this concept, the use of force. Keep going. This was done last year. European Union, non-U.S. forces, no U.S. involvement. If we're talking about humanitarian assistance, there's a great deal of willingness to be involved. If we're talking about potential operations against the Taliban, there's a much greater reluctance to be involved. And remember, the UN supports this. This is a NATO operation. There's a UN Security Council resolution. Nobody argues about legitimacy or international law. It's just, this is really not something they want to do. It's really dangerous. It's hard. It's far away. And I do not mean by my remarks to be critical. I don't mean to denigrate any concept. It's a very, very important idea to think about. And that's my only point tonight. But there is a difference that has evolved within the transatlantic relationship. And I am suggesting to you that the lack of the threat that came about because of the fall of the Berlin Wall has greatly catalyzed this. Here's some more on this. Again, a much greater European willingness for assistance, and they're wonderful when we talk about assistance and peacekeeping operations. Troops for combat operations, only 20% would be willing to do that. And again, when I talk about Afghanistan, it is something that NATO says it's okay and the UN says it's okay. And finally, the last one, contribute to reconstruction efforts. They're pretty much okay with us on that. But once it comes to Afghanistan, again, and the threat of the use of force, much lower. Those were illustrations. A couple of others. In the Balkans, mid-90s in Bosnia, the late 90s in Kosovo, a tremendous reluctance on the part of the European powers to employ force. I was the American liaison officer to the UN forces in Bosnia during the fighting in 95 when we were cut off. The reason we were there, the reason that the UN was there, it was a United Nations mission. I was the only one of only 12 Americans in the entire country at the time. And the reason we were there was to help the people in Sarajevo eat and be protected. and the Serbs had blockaded the city. And I was in a room one night when the three-star commander of Bosnia, of the UN, ordered a French two-star commander of the French forces there, of the Sector Sarajevo, to break the siege of Sector Sarajevo. And he refused in front of me. And he said, because if that happened, the Serbs would attack his troops. And the British three-star general said, this is Rupert Smith, and he said, but then the people won't be protected. We're not fulfilling our mandate. He said, I know, but I have to protect my troops. This was a real problem being manifested. In Kosovo in 1999, when you had the Serbian government conducting a certain degree of ethnic cleansing against the Albanian Kosovars, you had a similar problem there. While NATO supported an action to help back them up, there was a much greater reluctance on the part of the Europeans to put themselves or harm's way or employ force. When you take that forward now to what's happened in Afghanistan, well, we have been trying for 5 years now to increase the European presence. It's a non-starter. And basically, our policy is now, we're not going to get much further with that. Let's focus on other things so that we can make the operation work. My point of all this and my point of thought for all of you to consider as we walk through this the remainder of the evening and thinking about the future, the events of November 1989 had a dramatic impact in many, many ways in many, many levels of society. They had it on the individual level. They had it on the societal level for the German state, the German people and the German state. But they've also now, I would suggest, have had an impact that goes beyond Germany, that extends as a catalytic approach to this issue of the potential for the future of the use of force and the potential involvement and the willingness of Europe to have a certain degree of influence in the world writ large. Now, what that means for us and what that means for the people of the world where Europe has played such an important role, sometimes not always a good one, but a significant one through the centuries. And what that means is, I'd suggest, is up to you, up to all of us in this room to think about in the future. Thank you very much. I'll turn it back over to you. You can get that off. Do what you want.
Okay. We may be a little pressed for time, so I think we'll have to cut some of our dialogue short because I do want to get to questions. But to start it off, just as an observer to your comments, I was struck by the fact that I picked out themes of dislocation, that the fall of the wall, one impact, it was a jarring event on a personal level, on a societal level, and that some of these impacts, some of this shock is still felt today. I would like to just ask each of you, what else do you think is shocking about the fall of the wall, either on a personal level or, you know, to the German society, to the wider world, et cetera. And we'll start with Professor Mueller.
This is hard for me to say because there are so many things that were right. connected with the fall of the wall. There are certain things I regret. For instance, when the wall fell on November 9, 89, we were sitting in our basement with some friends and we were simply crying because it was such a monumental event. And I was particularly impressed by my former fellow East Germans who defied the strongest security apparatus in the world, I would say, maybe next to the North Koreans. And went into the streets and demonstrated and made this possible. Of course, there was a context to that, but they didn't know about the context, and they risked quite a bit, and they did it. On the other hand, the just one more personal experience, which was a little bit more philosophical in nature. When I came back to Berlin in 1990, and I went to Checkpoint Charlie for the first time the other way, from west to east, I was so disappointed that nobody was asking for my passport. I just walked through. And it made me think about what is important in life and what is eternal, what is fixed forever and what is transitory. And it was and the realization that walls, as high as they are, as protected as they are not there forever. That was an insight which I guess I hadn't had before, or I hadn't thought about very much. Of course, seeing friends again was great too. So.
Shock. I can't say that much in terms of what Jana still perceives as shock, but at least reading this, what shocked me, I think, in a certain way that I hadn't realized was something that was ongoing after the wall coming down, was that this this continual questioning of the of structures as being in place and being very similar in a certain way. Her description at the end of the big house in of Europe in Brussels, I thought was an interesting sort of universal bureaucracy image that surprised me. That there was so many similarities between her notion of bureaucracy from being under communism and what I would actually see as bureaucracy too.
If I could add just one more piece. One thing that struck me really until today, actually, in the life of a person and in the life of a nation, there are only a few moments which are sort of high times, utopian moments. In a personal life, it might be the birth of a child or a wedding, something like that. In the life of a nation, there are utopian moments like the fall of the wall, the first day of the French Revolution, July 4 for this country. It is a utopian moment because everybody is at their best. Even my uncle on November 10, 1989, he's not that nice a person. He went to the wall and he took his car and he took Easterners in to drive them wherever they wanted. And this was repeated a million times in the city on that day for the first 3 days, 4 days, 4 days. As we all know, utopias don't last long. As soon as the West Berliners noticed that they had to stand in line now to buy in the greatest department stores in West Berlin, and there are all these Easterners in front of them, the joy sort of diminished a little bit. But those 4 days are such wonderful days, and it doesn't happen very often, and I experienced it, even though from afar, and it will be with me all my life.
I'd suggest the shock is not over yet. For the countries of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, I would argue that they are still in the middle of a revolution. They're still transforming. The change that brought about, the opening that occurred, had an enormous impact on them. Almost impossible for those of us who grew up and have been in the West our entire lives. Where all of a sudden, whether it's on a human individual basis or on a state basis, there is now this prompting, this catalyst to move quickly, to move forward, to move ahead, where you don't control the pace anymore, where the world writ large is setting the pace for you. And so you're losing control of the life that you knew, the life that you had lived, the life that you had heard about. And while there were many things in it that you were uncomfortable with, and you're still more likely to prefer this than the alternative, it made life very, very difficult, and in some ways much more difficult than their parents had, because they had choices, they have opportunities that didn't exist in the past, but they're not certain they're going to be able to take advantage of. I just came back from a trip. At the end of September, I was in Azerbaijan for a few days, and I was with a number of people, universities, and within the government. And one of the things that's happening there is they had all these hopes, they had all these dreams, and they've been working really hard towards them, and they're not materializing. So they're just trying to send all their kids to college in the States. And then they're hoping, because their pensions are disappearing, they're hoping that their kids are going to get jobs and be able to take care of them in their old lives. Because they don't know who else is going to do it. The state used to do it, can't do it anymore. I'd suggest that's very, very shocking.
I'm keeping mindful of time here, and I would really like to open this up for the audience. I think that would be the best thing. Please, if you have any questions for the panel as a whole or for individuals, feel free to do that. And please speak into a microphone because this is being recorded.
Hi. My question is for Professor Stoltenberg, actually. I was wondering, we've talked in Professor Wolf's class a little bit about how during the Cold War was one of the more peaceful times because there wasn't as much active open conflict. What do you think about the current, bringing kind of the situation more to modern day, the deproliferation, I guess, of nuclear, non-proliferation of nuclear weapons? What do you think that that's going to do in terms of not having an active threat there and possibly opening up to more conflict? Does that make sense?
Are you referring to the impact of the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction?
The non-proliferation that's currently being discussed by President Obama.
Okay, the hope, okay, I see.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's late for all of us. I think, you know, it closes some doors and it opens others potentially. If you were to suggest the non-proliferation treaty came into being in 1970, created in 1968. There are 188 signatories to the non-proliferation treaty. And there are a number of major countries that haven't been willing, to include our own, to give up nuclear weapons and others that have other kinds of weapons of mass destruction. President Obama is saying, I really want to push hard with the non-proliferation treaty. There's a major clause in the non-proliferation treaty that said that all the signatories have to work ultimately to completely eliminate all nuclear weapons in the future. And he's saying he would like to work towards that. Well, I would argue that there's two sides to this. On one hand, if no countries have nuclear weapons or major weapons of mass destruction, and I think nuclear weapons is really what he's talking about today, then it makes the world safe from the employment of nuclear weapons. On the negative side, nuclear weapons would no longer be able to serve as a political deterrent to the employment of force of other countries. And so while on one hand, you could have a very positive outcome because you don't have Hiroshima's and Nagasaki's in the future, on the other hand, you have the threat of many smaller conflicts that could potentially happen because you no longer would have that deterrent effect. As a result, much like the issue we're talking about tonight at the impact of the fall of the wall, you would arguably have a much more complex, complicated situation that would be easier to exploit for someone who really wanted to do bad things. Food for thought.
I'm wondering how specifically what you guys were sort of talking about is, in terms of identity, the loss of the other. When there was a division between the East and the West, and you could kind of determine your identity because you were one or the other, with the dissolving of the wall came the dissolving of that clear-cut identity. And I'm wondering if this can kind of carry over into to your point to some degree, because there are sociologists who will argue that with the end of the Soviet Union, the United States had to find a different other. So I'm just sort of wondering if you think, what are the implications? We've been mostly talking about Europe. What are the implications of this same sort of process for America?
You mean whether the United States needs an enemy to define itself as a country?
Just do you think the same kind of identity crisis where, you know, we are what we are the West because we have, you know, the East to be against. The East comes down, Europe changes its complexion, and does America also kind of change its...
It's like the loss of the other.
Exactly.
And you make your own identity in opposition to someone else. That one person goes away.
Right.
What does that mean for you?
Right. And can we also see the implications? We've been mostly talking about Europe, and I'm just wondering, can we see that here?
I think, Alan, you actually you spoke to that a little bit in terms of saying that, yes, that is the case.
A little bit, but I'd suggest something else, too, here again as food for thought for all of us. I think there's also an argument out there that the United States has always been a fairly flexible culture and state. And we've always been pretty malleable, changing and adapting over time. Many of the other cultures that we're talking about in the world, not only in Europe, I would argue in Asia and Latin America as well, it's been historically much more difficult for them to adapt and change in a relatively short amount of time. And so I would suggest that it will have less impact on us in terms of a changing society than it would for most of the rest of the world. Clearly exceptions everywhere, because we have a history, we have a cultural history of being fairly flexible and malleable.
Yes. but things are also speeding up, and I'm not quite sure if we can keep up with this change that is speeding up. If you just look at demographics, for instance, within the next 20 years, people who look like us will be in the minority. This will have profound changes on society, and I think, and I think we need to change, and we need, and this country has changed, but the change itself in the world is speeding up quite a bit. But the other thing that I also wanted to say is, not only do we have to change, but we have to change in a way that creates an identity, that creates what I call a center of meaning, of a sense of purpose that other people can see as a model. If this does not happen, and if we do not change fast enough, I think we will bomb other people just to make more terrorists out of their descendants, and it will not be very good for us.
We have time for one more question.
Though the wall has been down for 20 years physically, do you think there are any specific areas in which mentally there might be a divide between the western and the eastern parts of Germany?
Just briefly, statistics are as follows. People who are about 20 years now, 18 to 20, only 11% define themselves as east or west. When you go to the 40-year-olds, you get numbers like 36% identify as either east or west. Older people, like myself, there the number is much, much higher. But it becomes difficult to define what that actually means, east and west, because the east and west is also overlapping traditional divisions between regions. As you know, Germany only became a country in 1871. It is a very young country. The region's so old, but the country as a country is very young. And that is so for a reason, because individual parts are so different. So on top of East and West, you have traditional divisions, and it's hard to keep those apart. What is what?
Not to mention what Jan also speaks to, which is while they may not distinguish themselves as East or West, their notion of what German is, I think, is still different.
One of the surprising slogans I saw on the wall when I was in Bremen in 1990 was, never again Germany, never again a united country. So I think one thing that is happening, as you probably know, Germany has been very self-reflective for the last 40 years, and nobody really wanted to identify to be German, really. Jana doesn't want to identify with the East, but to be German, for instance, when people said, well, that's really German, this was negative. For the West, but also for the East.
Yeah, but for different reasons.
There are overlapping reasons, yeah. Traditional ones and then the East-West conflict. This is changing, by the way. Germany, by younger people, is seen much more positive than, let's say, for my generation or for the generation that is now around 40 years old.
Please join me in thanking Professor Wolf and our panelists. On behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to thank everyone for coming and to have a nice evening. Yeah.